Would you like more Indefensive Plants each month? Well, you're in luck. Indefensive Plants is now offering bonus mini episodes over at our Patreon page. To find out how you can gain access to this bonus botanical content, head on over to patreon.com/indefensiveplants and consider becoming a patron. And as always, thank you for your continued support of Indefensive Plants. Together, we are helping cure plant blindness around the world, one episode at a time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the In Defense of Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefensiveplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. How's everyone doing this week? You hanging in there? You staying healthy? I certainly hope so. But most of all, I hope you're getting outside and doing some gardening. It's a great way to relieve some of the anxiety that's facing us, really, as a global society right now. I can't recommend gardening enough, so give it a shot if you're not doing it already. I think today's episode will help relieve even more anxiety because it's a really fascinating subject to talk about. Today we're joined by Jason Ligon, Micropropagation and Seed Bank Coordinator for the Atlanta Botanical Garden. Jason's got an incredible job growing orchids, carnivorous plants, and many other species of conservation concern, with the inevitable goal of putting them back out into the environment to restore population integrity for many of North America's rarest plant species. Jason's going to show us the ins and outs of what it takes to micropropagate orchids and other plants, and it's one of those conversations that really gives me hope for the future. Something we could all use a little bit more of. But yeah, I don't want to keep you from that any longer. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Jason. I hope you enjoy. All right, Jason Ligon, it is so awesome to have you on the podcast. How about we start off with a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Okay, yeah, sure. It's great to be here. So I'm Jason Ligon, and I am the Micropropagation and Seed Bank Coordinator at the Atlanta Botanical Garden. That is a long title, essentially to say that I grow and raise plants. So I think of myself as kind of a plant nursery, essentially. So where a lot of carnivorous plants and orchids and things get their start in the lab, it's up to me to take care of those things and actually see them grow up and then go out to the greenhouse and then back out to the wild a lot of times.
Yeah, that's got to be a really refreshing feeling and just an awesomely satisfying career most of the time. But I'm curious what brought you to this point. I mean, where did you get into plants? Have you always been into gardening? Where did this all start for you?
So I would say that thinking back on it now, it makes sense why I ended up where I did. But I grew up in the rural part of Waterloo, South Carolina. It's a town of about 200 people with no stoplights or anything like that. And so a lot of times for fun and things, my parents would just say, go outside. And so I would just go outside and just kind of wander around in the woods and all of those things and help my mom with her garden and things that she had. And so from a younger age, I think back to it. I remember finding pine cones and finding even sunflower seeds and things and trying to get them to grow. And I just found it fascinating to have the little terrariums inside of a little 1 liter bottle and things. And so fast forward, whenever I went to college, I studied environmental and natural resources at Clemson University with a concentration in conservation biology. And that's whenever I really started to get more into the taxonomy and learning more about the plant anatomy and things like that. So I think that that's really what got me into it. And while I was at Clemson, I was fortunate enough to study abroad in Equatorial Guinea.
Ooh.
I know, right? It's the one Spanish-speaking country in Africa. And so we were on a volcanic island there, and all of the students had a chance to do an undergraduate research project. And so they said to date, most or really all students had only done work with the animals on the island.
Of course.
I was like, what about the plants? Yeah.
Nice.
So they were saying, yeah, well, you can study begonias and impatiens and orchids and everything. I was like, what about just orchids? That's arguably the largest group of flowering plants. I think I'll have my workload cut out for me. So that's kind of where it started. So I did a census for orchids in Moka, Equatorial Guinea, and came back and interned with the Park Service with an internship there and kind of fell into place here at the Atlanta Botanical Garden, taking care of a first as an assistant horticulturist for the Orchid Center and then moving into the conservation department.
Wow, what an excellent trajectory. And yeah, it's one of those things that in hindsight, it makes a ton of sense, but it does, those paths seem to connect the right way, even whether or not you realize it at the time or not.
Right.
Ah, that's fantastic. And so, you know, you mentioned it, that you're in a lab, and it is interesting for people that don't realize what it takes to grow and propagate a lot of sensitive plant species like orchids. You know, you think about growing things in a greenhouse, setting up trays of soil, planting seeds in the dirt, and going from there. But it gets a little more trickier and specific than that for the kind of work that you're doing most of the time, right?
Right. So I would say in the grand scheme of things, it's the same concept. We're still growing plants, but it's just kind of instead of the potting soil, we're just using media and things instead. So the outcome, I would say, is exactly the same, where we're trying to grow things and propagate them, but we're just doing it on a smaller scale. And I think it would be good to point out, especially with orchid micropropagation, which is what we say that we do, it's different than tissue culture and some other terms that may be out there.
Okay.
And so for us, I think it's really important for listeners to kind of know the difference between those two.
Yeah, please tell us.
Yeah. So I would say that what we do at Atlanta Botanical Garden is really micropropagation from seed. So orchids themselves typically have a symbiotic relationship with a fungus. And so at some point in their life cycle, usually associated with germination, they actually feed on the associated fungi that's in their roots. And for us, we have typically grown them asymbiotically, so without life, essentially. So in the wild and things, they would associate with that mycorrhizal fungi. But in our lab, we grow things asymbiotically, because if we did want to reintroduce it out into the wild, we didn't want to put any type of things that weren't there before back out into the habitat or translocate any things that way. So whenever we're growing them asymbiotically, it's really important that we don't have any type of contaminants or anything like that in our lab setting. Whenever we're talking about seed micropropagation, it's important to know that, yes, it's the same as in the greenhouse, but how it varies from tissue culture is really about what you start with and what you end up with.
Okay.
So whenever you think of tissue culture, it's actually going to be taking a bud or node or piece of a plant, and you're going to be propagating it, and you're going to come out with propagules that are genetically identical to what you started with.
Okay.
Whereas with spore and seed micropropagation, you're actually going to have a genetically distinct individual from what you started with.
Okay. So it's the difference between cloning and sexual reproduction, essentially.
Right. Exactly.
Huh. Okay. And yeah, there's a good reason to consider that because of the conservation aspect of your work, right? I mean, it's one thing to clone a species to get it out to people that are just growing it as hobbyists, but to properly conserve a species, you have to consider all of that genetic diversity that you're either facilitating or potentially eliminating.
Right, of course. And so for us, it really comes down to keeping exceptional plant records, essentially. And so what that would really mean is we have really honed in on maternal line tracking whenever we're collecting seeds and then keeping track of those maternal lines as they're in the lab and then putting them back out. And so what that means with maternal line tracking, think of one maternal line as one plant. So we're able to track which seeds came from which plant. And so we can always go back that way.
Wow.
So whenever we're sampling for seeds to grow in our lab, we really keep track of each maternal line within one population. So that way, whenever we collect the seeds, grow them up, we can still have a good genetic representation of what was there in that population.
Yeah, and that's impressive, just to say right out of the gates. Like, that level of record keeping is so impressive, but so vital to the success of these projects. But it also entails a lot of collaboration and at least working together with people both in the field, doing the collections, and then eventually into the lab. And then I'm guessing as soon as they get to the point where they can be reintroduced. I mean, this takes a lot of communication all throughout the process, right?
Definitely. We like to say that conservation is a collaborative science, and it is so true, because we really depend on our dedicated volunteers and staff members, and then partners as well, different nonprofits and government agencies and things, to actually be able to be out in the field collecting plants, while they are in our lab and then actually helping us with the outplanting of the same species as well.
Dang. And how far are you guys reaching in terms of where your areas of interest for a lot of these plants are? I mean, we can go into more specifics in a little bit, but is it mostly centered around the Southeast, or are you going farther out, you know, say past Georgia, North Carolina, those states?
Yeah, good question. So typically we focus on the ones that are endemic to the Southeastern U.S. because we are based here in Atlanta, Georgia. However, a lot of times species don't obey political borders. So sometimes you'll get the same species that may occur in southern Florida, but then also have a population in the Bahamas or in Cuba or somewhere like that. And then also there are ones that we look at in order to have a cross comparison with. So species that may not be the same in Florida and the Southeast as in South America, but that same genus may occur in both areas, and say, how did the ones from outside of the Southeast compare to ones of the same genus and things from other areas of the world? But right now, I believe we have projects at the Atlanta Botanical Garden that range all throughout the Southeast. So our plants and their distribution, they go from Texas all the way over to Florida and up into North Carolina and Kentucky in that area. Wow. And then internationally as well, the garden does touch on projects in Cuba, the Bahamas, Puerto Rico, and currently in Ecuador as well. And we're actually starting new collaborations in some countries in Asia, and then also back to Colombia as well. So we have a pretty far reach right now for what we can do.
Yeah, that's really impressive. And I mean, even just to focus on the Southeast, an area that is so rich in botanical diversity is a task in and of itself. But to have that collaboration and those partnerships really allows those you know, conservation dollars to go a lot farther.
Yes, it definitely does. So for us especially, we have a limited amount of staff and volunteers and things. So in order to collect what we need to and do the work we need to get done, it really is, it's vital that we actually partner with these other people. And a lot of times they will raise awareness of other plants and things that we may not have had on our radar, or we may have thought that it was the only thing that was important. And then we realize that, oh, multiple partners and people throughout the Southeast are actually interested in these same species. Let's work collaboratively in order to make those dollars stretch as far as possible.
Right on. Yeah. And it is, having seen a little bit behind the scenes and talked to, you know, you and your colleagues throughout, you know, the last few years, it is really impressive and super inspiring. But in thinking about what's going on in your lab when you're coming to work every day, you know, this is a process that involves some planning and some effort. And obviously a lot of sterile laboratory procedures. So why is it that, you know, we talked a little bit about what makes like orchid seeds very special. Why is it that these procedures have to be put into place? I mean, why is it that the average gardener can't just grab a bunch of orchid seeds, sprinkle them in their backyard, and boom, you have orchids? You know, why does it need this laboratory setting?
I think for us, the best way to think of it is the level of record keeping that we're trying to accomplish here. So I would say that if someone were to stumble across a capsule of orchid seed, and if that person wanted to plant them in their backyard, they could. However, whenever it rains, are you guaranteed to know that these dust-like seeds are actually where you planted them? And would you be able to identify which species you have growing in your backyard and things? So a lot of times it comes down to that, the level of record keeping that you want to do and be able to scientifically track how best to grow these species. So what we're really focusing on now is getting to a species-specific protocol for a lot of the orchids that we're working with.
Wow.
So a lot of times that would mean coming into the lab and actually seeing if one species, one maternal line even, is going to grow better on this media type versus that, to see if we need to incubate it in the dark or in the cold for 8 weeks or 10 weeks or 16 weeks in order to optimize the growth and germination of that species. So a lot of times it may not be as controlled in a greenhouse setting or even at a home setting or backyard setting. So yeah, so that's what we're really trying to get towards and why we have have to have such a controlled environment is because we're just trying to have one variable change in that scientific method.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's so cool to have brought that up. And I never, you know, I so rarely go to that side of it, but it does make so much sense that you want to develop these protocols for species-specific projects. And then thinking about, you know, those little nuances that make species unique among themselves. Whenever people say like, oh, no, biology is all the same. It's neutral theory. It's like baloney. Try growing plants. They're all different. But let's talk through the process a little bit more now. I mean, you show up to work. You have a capsule of orchid seeds sitting in front of you. What's next? I mean, where do you go from there?
Sure. So I will again reiterate that you can grow the orchid seeds symbiotically with that fungus, or you could grow it asymbiotically. So I'll go more into detail first about the asymbiotic method, because that's what we focus on mostly at our space. So essentially, if we were to get in the capsule of orchid seeds, or if we were to get the already loose seeds in, we would try to work as quickly as possible just to make sure that we're not losing any viability with that seed. So that kind of comes first and foremost, keeping good records and then working as quickly as possible, because a lot of times just at ambient temperatures and things, it may lose some viability. Hmm. So just keep in mind the whole process. We're not running through the lab, but we are trying to work as efficiently as possible to get it sown or to get it banked. And so if we get in the seed, we'd ideally want to do a viability test. And so obviously the most useful for me would be a germination test, which we're going to go into. We're essentially going to be planting it into the tub. But another way to get that initial viability would be to use a tetrazoleum test, where you're actually staining it, and then actually viable tissue would stain red. Oh. So you'd be able to look under a microscope and see if that embryo is actually red versus white, and you'd be able to see, oh, this percent viability of that maternal line, oh, this is 80% to start with, fresh seed, or, oh, this maternal line only had 20% viability to begin with. Wow. So that's really important whenever you go forward and you've sown out your seed. You wouldn't be really expecting to get 100% germination from all of those seeds, but you'd really only be expecting 80% or 20% respectively.
Jeez.
Yeah. So we like to go ahead and do that initial viability test. And then after we've done that, we divide up the seed from that one line, and we'll actually store some for later and future viability tests. And we'll go forward with the process, and we'll actually start sowing it in vitro. So in vitro, we talk about that. You may think of in vitro fertilization or something like that. Hmm. But for us, in vitro, it comes from Latin meaning in glass. So essentially, we are working in little baby food jars and little plastic tubs these days. So we're actually working, we're working to sow them in vitro. And so what that starts with is, after that viability test and after we've banked some of the seed, we're going to actually add a bleach solution to the seed. Huh. And add in tween, which is essentially going to help break that surface tension, because orchid seeds are hydrophobic and would just kind of sit on top of the water and not really be cleaned.
Hmm.
But again, since we're growing them asymbiotically on this little track here, we want to make sure there's nothing else in that container in vitro that would adversely affect the seed. So we're going to have a bleach solution, and then that tween that's going to really help that bleach stick to the seed and clean it. And it really depends on how dark the seed coat is. So the darker a seed coat is, typically the longer you would have to wash it in that bleach solution. Huh. And then the lighter that seed is, the less time it would need. But I would say on average, it's usually between, I would say, about 7 minutes up to about 20 minutes. And once that seed is cleaned, then we would actually, there are different methods to sow it into the container, but we typically err on the side of the funnel method. And so it's kind of what it sounds like. So we have autoclaved, which will sterilize all of our materials from now forward in all this process. And we'll work inside of a laminar flow hood, which has a very fine filter and is pushing out sterile air. And we'll have our autoclaved funnel and filter paper that we'll put up there, and we will dump the washed seed into that filter paper and then rinse it with sterilized water. So that way it's as clean as possible, and we're trying to guarantee that no contaminants have gotten in from the air or anything. And then we will actually use that filter paper to wipe over the surface of the auger that's in the container, and we'll just close it up, seal it, and label it, and that seed is on its way to asymbiotic germination.
Wow.
So that's one method.
Yeah, that's incredible. And I love how much, you know, having been behind the scenes at the lab and seen the tours that you've given, it is amazing how much this kind of mirrors what you would see in like an epidemiology lab. If anyone's ever had like their throat swabbed and watched them put it on those auger dishes, it is a very similar process, which is why you want so much sterility. Bacteria and other things love to grow in those situations.
Yeah, exactly. So again, since we're growing them asymbiotically, without that fungus that it would usually associate with, we have to supplement that nutrition it would have been getting from the fungus with a nutrient-rich media. And so in that media, you're going to have a lot of sucrose, sometimes charcoal and other ingredients that bacteria, viruses, as we're all familiar with these days, and fungi would love to grow on. And so if you were to just take it out in the open air or, God forbid, cough into it, you would see an array of different things kind of sprout there.
Oh,
so that's why we try to work as clean as possible, as sterile as possible, just to kind of circumvent any contamination there.
Whew. A little nerve-wracking sometimes, maybe?
Yeah, I would say so. I would say so. I always, because our lab is at about 70 degrees and things, it's a little chillier than I would like. And so it typically causes my nose to run or drip,
no.
But it makes me it makes me a little paranoid about, am I getting sick? Am I going to contaminate the container? But no, but it's pretty gratifying though, I would say. Once you actually start to see those seeds germinate and things, it's definitely worth it.
Yeah, and you did show me a little vial of sort of later in the germination phase, those protocorms, but for something coming out of such a tiny, tiny seed. I mean, I can't emphasize enough how tiny orchid seeds are. I mean, what are those early days like? Obviously, it varies from species to species how long you have to wait to see anything, but you go through those protocols, figure out what it wants. What are the early days of orchid seed germination look like?
Yeah, so after we've sown the seed, that's when it's just a waiting game. A lot of times, if there isn't protocol that's already established of it needing to be germinated in the dark or in the cold, a lot of times you don't know. So I'm very happy whenever the people who've come before me have figured out the protocols for how to grow a lot of these things so that I'm not starting from scratch. And so you can kind of anticipate, oh, this person had to wait 8 weeks or this person had to wait 3 months. That way you're not biting your nails, you know, two days in thinking, what have I done wrong? but a lot of times, what will happen is we sow it and we wait. So we know where to put it or we don't know where to put it, and we'll actually stratify it in different ways to try to optimize that faster germination. And what we're really looking for is for that seed coat to break open. Essentially, what will happen is that seed will swell with water and then eventually it will break open and you'll see that protocorm, as you mentioned, sprout. And so that's kind of the first growth for the orchid life stage, and you will see a little, it looks like a little green sphere that comes out, and it has little rhizoids on it. And then from that, you'll actually see the first true leaf and first true root come out of it.
Yeah.
But as you said, yeah, it really does depend on which species it is, how long it takes. But yeah, that could just be different light cycles of being incubated in 12 hours of light or 10 hours of light, or sometimes completely in the dark or in the cold and things, in order to break some of that dormancy.
Right, because a lot of these, again, are from North America. I mean, you guys have a much milder winter down there than we do, but nonetheless, these plants would go through some sort of dormancy period. They don't want their seeds germinating right away, and you have to respect that element of its natural history, really.
Exactly, exactly. And so I am working in a lab, but I'm glad that I have come from a background in horticulture and field work and things as well, so I can kind of see the picture holistically in order to not be so disconnected from what a plant really needs. What we're really trying to replicate in the lab is what nature has been doing for eons.
Right. The best and sometimes harshest teacher.
Yeah.
But is this process similar then for, say, you know, you showed me some pine lily seedlings and then you also had pinguiculas and you mentioned other carnivorous plants. I mean, is this a similar process for other seeds that you're trying to micropropagate in a lab?
Right. So again, with all of those other things that aren't orchids, we would be growing them just as I described, asymbiotically, because we're not expecting any association with fungi. And yeah, it's very similar to it. We're going to surface sterilize the seed. We'll go ahead and sow it, and then we will sit and wait a lot of times. The variation would be really in the type of media that we're putting it on, and potentially the light cycle, and then the timing that we're waiting for those other species to germinate.
Right on. Yeah. So it's just, again, thinking about where these plants come from and what they're doing and kind of following in the footsteps of, or maybe doing the experiments needed to create your own footsteps in that process.
Right. Right.
Very cool. And it's got to be such a fun combination of, you know, tinkering in a lab, doing experiments, but also knowing that everything you're doing has massive implications for conservation of species.
Oh, yes. So it can be overwhelming to just think of what you're doing in the grand scheme of things. I really feel grateful for my position and the team that I work with, because we are literally saving the world's plants, and we are directly hands-on working with these rare and endangered species. And so what we're doing as a department, and a lot of our collaborators as well, is we're really focusing on those globally and essentially state imperiled and critically imperiled species. And so if you were to look through the window at our lab, you would really see a great representation of some of the most rare and endangered species right there.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember you handing me that vial of pine lily seedlings, and I'm like, all right, this is already more than I've ever seen in the wild. And I mean, that's got to be a feeling you must experience on a daily basis, is looking into these tiny vials and going like, wow, that is so many rare plants in the palm of my hand.
Oh, yes. And again, kind of the reason why we do micropropagation and seed banking, it's a conservation strategy. Yes, you could drive out to the wild and try to sow them out there and monitor them out there, but it's just more time efficient and cost efficient to have a lot more plants in a more concentrated area, and being able to monitor them and actually change small variables and things as you're growing them and keep better records with it.
For sure. Yeah. And again, those records, as you've reiterated since the beginning of this talk, are so vital to that conservation component. But also thinking about time aspect of this, and you know, as an orchid grower, I realize orchids do pretty much nothing with urgency. It is a slow burn. It's a very rewarding burn. So from, say, germination to getting them to a point where you could potentially pot them up or move them out to a potential reintroduction site, I mean, sometimes that can take a bit of time, right?
Oh, yes. So I would say on average with our orchids in the lab, it would be about 2 to 4 years, I would say, wow, is how long that they would stay in the lab. And obviously, we're trying to work to expedite that process. But sometimes you can't rush nature, and it will just take it 3 months or longer in order for things to even start to germinate. And then once they've actually grown, that next step is they don't stay in the same container. We have to actually do transfers. And so open up those sterile containers and actually transfer them to a successively larger container, so they have space to grow and things. They're not too overcrowded. But yeah, on average, it's about 2 to 4 years that they could stay in the lab. And then after that, we would want to harden it off in the greenhouse for at least one season before we would actually plant it back out into the wild.
Oh, wow. So yeah, there is multiple steps between what you do and then eventually getting it out.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, after they leave my hands, they would go to the greenhouse and we'll just monitor them there. Because if you think about it, they've been spoiled to death in the lab, and they have those ideal conditions, or as close to it as possible, to really give them the best growing environment and the best chance. But then they're going to have to go back out into the real world, where they're going to be faced with all types of potential diseases, potential pests, all of these things. And so we don't have any control over it at that point, but we do try to stage it in a way so that they are protected, and it's a logical progression whenever they go to the greenhouse. And then, of course, once we plant them out into the wild, we're still going back and following up and monitoring them, right, just to see how well they did as well.
Yeah. And now, before we get into sort of that end of it, thinking about success rates and whatnot, you know, we've talked that there is this other method, this symbiotic raising these orchids per se with the symbiotic fungus they need. And I realize that is by no means what you specialize in. How does that process differ? Obviously, you're not sterilizing everything when you're trying to get them introduced with fungus and whatnot.
So we actually are.
Oh, okay.
So so we actually are going to do it the same way. So how a symbiotic varies from the asymbiotic would be in what you inoculate the seed with. So you've already sown it asymbiotically, again, to ensure that nothing else is in there, because you only want to have that one variable of what specific fungi you've introduced to it. And so how it varies is really in obtaining that fungus. And you have to have a different media grown specifically for that fungal growth. And once you have that fungus cultured, that's whenever you would take a sliver of that media with the fungus and you would put it into that plate that has the seed in it. And so that's the big difference there, is that there's that addition of that fungus at a later state, but they've all been sown the same way asymbiotically, and then you choose which fungus you would actually introduce with it. And it's a lot more complicated a lot of times, because there are different taxonomic units that you can use to identify those mycorrhizal fungi, but without genetic analysis, you don't know exactly which ones they are. But again, it's not our specialty. There are other organizations leading the way in that, but we are getting more into that just to look at a more holistic approach to habitat restoration and augmentation and things as well. But I think that it's fascinating. But essentially, yeah, with that, you have to consider, a lot of times the mycorrhizal fungi are species specific. And then other times you'll have more generalist fungi that may associate with several different species, or possibly even different genera as well. And so it's really important that we understand that interaction in things. But at this stage, we're just trying to compare and seeing how that affects the overall health and reintroduction of a lot of species.
Right. And is it still kind of early days for any sort of conclusions to be drawn there? Or do you have some ideas that certain ones do better than others?
I would say that the jury's still out. And I would say that for us, at the Atlanta Botanical Garden, we don't have anything conclusive. We're just in the very beginning stages of forming those partnerships and figuring out what our resources are and what species we really want to hone in on.
Right. No, that's interesting. And it is cool to know that that's sort of a forefront in the coming, you know, years, decade or so. And it's a lot of it's ushered in by the advances that we've made in technology with cheap genome sequencing and whatnot. But kind of going back to something you hinted at earlier on in the conversation, is this idea that you don't want to necessarily just willy-nilly introduce things, whether that be something we view as a beneficial symbiont like a mycorrhizal fungus species, or, you know, something up to a potential invasive plant species. We all know how bad that can go. So that is a really interesting thing to consider, is, you know, it's one of those situations where if a little bit is good, more must be better, but not always. You know, just because there's a mutualist in one region of the world doesn't mean it's going to behave or do good things in another region of the world. You want to avoid any unnecessary introductions, right?
Right, right. And so I think that that kind of really goes back to, again, our institution's role in the whole picture of it, is if we can grow them and establish those protocols for asymbiotic germination and growth of the orchids, then at a later date, we could decide to inoculate it with the different fungi, whether it be a generalist or more species specific. And then even if you think about a species specific fungus, ones that have a larger range, for example, Platanthera chapmanii or something that may range from the eastern coast to Texas and things, it may not be the same fungus that's going to be working with each of those plants at different populations throughout its range.
Yeah, so more data required. These things get complicated. Dang. Oh, man, a lot to consider. And thinking about that, like you said, it sometimes can feel overwhelming. I mean, are there days where you're like, I don't know. I don't know if I should be trusted with these.
Well, yes.
I guess, okay.
I would say that
I was going to let me rephrase that question. So earlier in the conversation, you mentioned this idea that sometimes you have the fortune of building on what others have done before you. Maybe they've already figured out the protocol for the species, but in other times you have to do your homework. You have to know something about the natural history and run experiments just to see what's going on. So when you're faced with your day-to-day, week-to-week sort of operations there, would you say it's more often you're building on the work of others? You know, there's a lot of protocols in place, or is it more often that you have to do the experiments and figure things out? I guess what this comes down to is have we figured out most of the species you work with, or are there still many unknowns?
There are still many unknowns, but I would say that most of what I'm doing is going to be built off of that scientific research that's already been done. And again, we're just changing small things and just tweaking what's already been done in order to advance the field a little bit farther. So I think the most exciting part about my job is going into the unknown, and it'll probably be what makes me go gray prematurely. But it's really thinking about where we haven't gone before. What haven't we solved? I believe we kind of have a little hit list, essentially, of which species we really want to work with, and we really want to nail down their protocol. And it's time and time again that other organizations, and our organization included, have tried to grow and just haven't been successful with. And those are really where we're trying to focus our research and our efforts and things, because again, we have a comfort zone of, yes, we can grow this really well. Sometimes you may even say, oh, it's easy to grow, but we're trying to grow it better and faster. And we're trying to make those plants that are outplanted last longer, because we're not just trying to do it for our own benefit, but we're really trying to do it for the benefit of the species. And so, yes, there's still a lot more unanswered questions about the ecology of orchids and how they fit in within their biome and things. And so that's really where we're trying to take our research to that next level and actually really see long-term growth and sustainability of those populations.
Right on. And I love hearing sort of that excitement about challenge and enjoying the process of it all, but also knowing that you have the satisfaction of it being virtuous work. I mean, there's no other way to put it. This is really important for biodiversity, for ecosystem health, and it's so nice to know that you get to play and do something good for the planet at the same time.
Right. Yeah. There aren't enough jobs like that.
Yeah, unfortunately. But you're lucky to have one that is. So in thinking about this, obviously this comes down to the species level. I mean, you're doing this on a species by species basis. So in your experience in propagating orchids and doing work with the Atlanta Botanical Gardens throughout, I mean, have there been some memorable species? I'm not going to ask you for your favorite because I know how difficult that question can be, but what are some species that kind of stand out throughout this process and why?
Okay. I would say that I could divide them into a few different categories for different reasons. Cool. I would say that some stand out because they're easy to grow. I like those. Those make my life a little easier. So I would think of it on the genus level, essentially. But if we're thinking about the different genera out there, some that are easier for us to grow would be things like Paphiopedilums and Phragmopediums, the different slipper orchids. And I would say even things like Stanhopia from our Fuqua Orchid Center. We have a great species collection there. And I would really say a lot of times it's because of the number of seeds we get. So the ones like the Paphiopedilums and some of the Phalaenopsis and even the Stanhopia, those for me are fun and relatively easy because we have a plethora of seed to work with. So those are enjoyable, I would say. But I would say other ones could be more memorable just because of their conservation value and things like that. I will talk about the Phragmopedium cavaquii. That's one that has a beautiful purple flower, and it's one that's very rare in cultivation. And so being able to see those little seedlings growing up in their lab and remembering back to when I worked for the Fuqua Orchid Center and we actually hand pollinated it, and now actually seeing those grow up is really fulfilling. Wow. So kind of being there long enough to see some of those capsules that I set on those orchids come through the lab and things 3 and 4 years later is really gratifying. And then other ones, as we said, would be the ones of conservation concern. So the ones like the ghost orchid that I believe I showed you, The ghost orchid is one that's it's both enjoyable because it's relatively simple, but then also just for its conservation concern. It's one of those leafless orchids that's native to Florida. And so that one's just a nice, easy one, but also has conservation value. And of course, we have quite a few of our Platanthera chapmanii and integralabia. And even Habenaria and Calopogon and things are ones that we work with. And those, just knowing their conservation value, are just fun and fulfilling to see grow up.
Yeah, all good reasons and all great species too.
Yeah.
Lucky, no, but it is amazing to think about sort of the timeline that plants work on. They work on a time scale that humans don't readily, and especially a lot of funding agencies don't readily kind of give into. And so the fact that you've been there and been through different processes of growing plants and propagating them, that is such a unique perspective to get. And how often do people get to see, like you said, going from a capsule to a tiny seed to a protocorm, all the way up to plants that are now getting ready to, you know, make their way into a greenhouse or even potentially go back outside? I mean, it's got to bring you so much closer to these species than if you were just kind of in there for a couple of years and then moving on to the next thing.
Oh, yes, I agree. I would like to think that I'm not emotionally attached to these plants, but I believe at some level I am. But I think that's going to be true of anybody who goes into plant conservation, is you do actually have that connection with what you're doing. And I would say that that's true of everyone on my team and everyone at the Botanical Garden as well, who work directly with these plants. And it just gives you that deep appreciation to be working hands-on with these species that are so important.
Yeah, for sure. And again, just having the inspiration of others with similar goals but different skill sets. I mean, you are really kind of in the heat of battle with this, but with the best possible players in this game.
Yeah, I like to think so.
That's fantastic. And then, you know, from the conservation standpoint, all of this is gearing up to hopefully getting plants back out in the wild if their habitat still exists. And, you know, how much of a hand do you have in that process? Do you at least get to see some of the fruits of your labor going back out into the wild to potentially reinvigorate a species that might not be doing so hot?
I don't think they let me out of the lab.
No!
But I do actually get to get out some. So other people on our team, as you said, with other specialties, are really at the forefront of that habitat restoration, working on that habitat level in order to augment that. And for example, we have people on our team who are trained for prescribed burns and actually work with our partners with different state agencies in order to actually open up the canopy and cut down trees when needed and things to let more sunlight in. So there is that habitat restoration that goes along with it. It's not, I work on a more of a species specific level, but I would say that our department, though, is really looking at those imperiled plants and their natural communities as a whole. And I would say for field work, when I do get out of the lab, it would be for things like the seed collection trips, which I really enjoy. So we, for example, last year we were funded through the Kew Foundation America and the Center for Plant Conservation in order to go out and collect two priority species that are considered globally critically imperiled. So that was the Tilimnium alesii and Dicerandra radfortiana. And we were able to go out into the field, and you talked about they're not orchids, but again, it was a seed collection trip which came through me and things because they needed to be banked. And so, yeah, that was really fun because, as we were talking about, there wasn't a protocol really in place for how to collect or when to collect and all of those things. And so we used the Center for Plant Conservation's best practices, and we went forward with collecting them that way and then getting them back in a timely manner and banking them and things. But that was really fun to kind of be out there and strategize how to collect that representative genetic diversity from across its range at each site as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. And again, so cool to be involved in all steps of the process from beginning to end, really.
Yeah, I think, again, it's really helpful for me to be there from the beginning through the end and things, just to kind of not have so many changes of hand, I would say, along the process. Having that consistency for the plants seems to be really helpful.
Yeah, and that is a point that I think doesn't get touched on enough, is just how much turnover can damage projects like this, even with the best intentions. I mean, if you've got different people doing different things, even if it's like little tweaks to their protocol, you know, like you said, the fewer exchange in hands, sometimes the better it is in the long run for these plants. So it is nice to see this sort of start to finish.
Right. And then again, it kind of harkens back to the partners for plant conservation. And so really just making sure that anyone interested in that habitat or that species, we kind of agree on the same outcome and things. So that way it'll affect what steps we take to get there and achieve the same goal.
Right. Right. And so looking ahead, I mean, obviously you are, you know, in the thick of it. There's always more work to be done. But what are you excited about, you know, moving forward with some of the propagation work?
Oh, so I will say I'm most excited about getting more into the symbiotic germination for our orchids and then also those alternatives to micropropagation. Mm. So you have to have me back again for a whole interview about seed banking.
Sure.
Because we've only lightly touched on it.
Right.
But essentially for me, seed banking comes first. It's the most space efficient and usually cost efficient way to bank that genetic diversity. And then if you can't do that because the seeds don't allow for traditional seed banking, then there are going to be alternatives to that. Mm-hmm. And so right now, even if you look at the Millennium Seed Bank and their website, you will see that only about 60% of the orchids they've tested are actually orthodox, which means that they can be stored in a conventional seed bank, whereas the other ones you can't store in that way. So one thing that I'm really excited about is actually looking for other alternatives to that conventional seed bank, storing it at negative 20 Celsius, but instead looking into cryopreservation.
Nice.
So we're really going more into that in order to preserve the pollen and then some of those non-orthodox seeds as well.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. So thank you for giving me yet another episode to schedule you in for.
Sure.
But yeah, those are really exciting techniques. And I love seeing technology being put to good use. You know, it is often you think about some of these things as sort of like nature and back to earth. But oftentimes technology can be very important tools in making this process far more sustainable and far more doable, I guess, in the long run.
Right. And I think that's what we're all about, is really trying to be at the forefront of applying all of these innovative strategies in order to conserve plants a little bit better.
Excellent. What else do you have going on? I mean, obviously you have a varied amount of interests. What else is going on in your life?
Yeah. So as if that weren't enough, outside of the garden, I also act and then write and things as well. So just like you, Matt, actually trying to raise more awareness for plants and just that kind of intrinsic value of them. So I've actually been writing a series called Platonic Plants, and it's just a short video format in order to bring more awareness to plants and actually connect people better with plants. As you may realize, in the midst of the pandemic, one of the safe alternatives is getting back out into nature and things like that. And so I really am trying to focus on writing episodes that people can really use in order to improve their plant ID skills and just learn quick facts about the plants that are around them out there.
Oh, that's fantastic. And is this something that you're not yet ready to release, or is there a place people can go looking for it? Where are we at with it?
So right now it would be on Instagram. So it would be at Botany Blackout would be my handle. And there you'll see all the updates with it. This little pandemic has put a small wrench into plans, but it should still be coming out later this year.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I'll put up links to all the relevant stuff on the show notes for this episode. But Jason, thank you for giving us a light into this incredible process of protecting plants and ensuring that at least these species will be around for future generations to appreciate and enjoy. So thank you for all the work that you're doing, and thank you for talking with us today.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. And if anyone would like to follow up on the work that we're doing, you can also follow the Atlanta Conservation and Research Department on Instagram at @AtlantaBGConservation as well.
Fantastic. I'll make sure to link that one too.
Sure.
Wonderful. Well, Jason, again, thank you so much for talking with us. It was a real pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you, Matt.
All right. Cheers. All right, that's about it for this week. What an incredible job Jason has. It's really cool, and if you ever find yourself at the Atlanta Botanical Garden, do what you can to get on a tour of the micropropagation lab, or at least walk through and peer in the windows to see what that situation is all about. It's really cool to see. I thank Jason for taking time out of his busy schedule to talk with us, and I wish him all of the best moving into the future with all of these incredible rare plants that he's working with. Before I leave you today, I want to give a shout out to the latest producers on this show. A big shout out to Kendall and Vibhav. They went over to patreon.com/indefensiveplants and signed up at the producer credit level. So they're getting all of the benefits that you could possibly get from our Patreon, including all of those bonus episodes each and every month. If you want to help support the show and ensure that it can keep coming out each and every week on a regular basis, please consider signing up over at Patreon. It is the best way to give this show a future. I couldn't be doing it without these people, and I'm extremely fortunate that so many people are continuing to give to the show despite what's going on in the world right now. So thank you very much to everyone who has donated and shown their support. If you can't financially support the show, I completely understand. At the very least, tell your friends, get other people to listen. Word of mouth is one of the best ways that podcasts can grow. But yeah, keep tuning back in. So many great things just over the horizon. I say that each and every week, but it's true. I'm so excited for all the content I get to bring you each week. But until then, I hope you're staying safe, I hope you're staying healthy, and hang in there. It's the best we can do right now, and we're all in this together. Until next week, this is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios, everyone.